Good morning, and welcome to Many Paths, Many Visions, brought to you by the Labyrinth Society, and with your host, Christiana Brinton. In conjunction with the theme for the Labyrinth Society annual gathering this year, Diverse Journeys on a Common Path, Building Community Through the Labyrinth, our series for the remainder of 2016 will have a similar theme, using labyrinths to address social issues. This is our fifth episode, and listeners can live chat with my guests and me during the 15-minute Q&A session at the end of the interview. And for those listening live to this podcast, please do take the time to log in and chat with us. It certainly livens up the show and provides welcome and helpful feedback. This episode is entitled Weaving Peacemaking with Social Justice on the Labyrinth. And my guest today is Reverend Dr. Catherine McLean, one of the concurrent workshop presenters at this year's gathering. Dr. McLean is an ordained Presbyterian minister, chaplain, spiritual director, and a Veritas-certified advanced labyrinth facilitator. Welcome to Many Paths, Many Visions, Catherine. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Christiana. It is a joy to be a part of this conversation with you.
Well, it's you know, I've had some pretty interesting people on so far. And are we getting any feedback? Do you hear any feedback? Just want to make sure that that doesn't happen. I think I was a little too close to the mic. Let's try this again here. And all of these, all of my other interviews have been about people using labyrinths for their work, their passion, as it relates to issues that we're facing, cultural issues, social issues, across the board, across the world. And this applies to you too, Catherine. You just completed a multi-year doctoral research thesis focusing on the labyrinth's role in building, sustaining, and transforming community. And it was just accepted in May of this year. So briefly, why did you decide to do your doctoral dissertation on this subject? And this is for the McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. Why on this subject?
Well, thank you for asking. In my vocational roles as a chaplain and a spiritual director and pastor and labyrinth facilitator, I was really acutely aware of a growing sense of people's disconnection with their from their communities of faith and from a sense of community in general. And I noticed that the anxiety that came along with that was significant, in addition to the obvious kind of polarization of our society on political, theological, and economic levels. That concern was a catalyst for me in seeking some more understanding about building, sustaining, and transforming communities. I chose McCormick Theological Seminary because it has a commitment to a multicultural, interfaith, and socially engaged faculty and student body. And the fact that they offered a particular doctoral program titled Building Beloved Community just captured in a phrase my hope and my desire to learn more.
And how did the labyrinth enter into this?
I had been a labyrinth facilitator since the late 90s, early 2000s. And as I introduced the labyrinth to several of the communities that I served, I noticed that when people walked the labyrinth in community and individually, that there were particular things that they experienced and shared with me, whether it was a reduction in anxiety or a connection with the group that they were with that was deeper than had been before, or an openness and willingness to come together on a labyrinth as a common ground space, even if they were from different communities or different faith traditions, different age groups. I saw the labyrinth begin to become this neutral space that was safe, since no one or no organization or theological tradition or culture or community owns the labyrinth. It is open to all. And I was fascinated by the way the safety of that space seemed to hold so many people in whatever part of the journey of life that they were in, and begin to allow them some space to deal with some of the anxiety, both on a personal level, but also within their families and communities and organizations.
So can you please explain the structure that you created to measure and quantify your research?
Sure. I followed the seminary's formal thesis research requirements and guidelines. I had release forms and permission slips and confidentiality agreements that each participant signed in order to participate, so they knew that any information that they shared would not be used without their permission and for the most part would be anonymous. I carefully created interview questions which covered both in a narrative sense the participants' understanding and background with labyrinths, as well as more data-based objective questions about their particular engagement with the labyrinth. I asked 13 questions about certain areas of interest, such as social justice and connecting communities of people to other communities, spiritual formation, community building, discernment, healing, grief work, many topics. And then I collected demographic information about each participant and their personal and communal experience with labyrinths. I conducted about 55 interviews lasting between 1 and 2 hours. I made about 31 site visits to labyrinths in their particular contexts and met with as many of the labyrinth creators and people in that community that the labyrinth was situated in. And then I researched theological theory and leadership theory and some psychological theory, as well as the history of the labyrinth in communities, so that I could look through various lenses and disciplines. And then I was invited to help with a community of 400 older adults in a retirement community that was in transition in Florida. They really looked forward to the possibility of including a labyrinth to help their community through the changes that they were experiencing and to provide, again, a neutral, safe, sacred space for their residents as they aged and formed community there.
You mentioned visiting 31 labyrinth sites and focusing, you provided this information to me, and focusing on 7 of them as examples of best practices by both the community and the labyrinth creators. Can you please explain what you mean by this? What do you mean by best practices?
That is kind of a formal research term, but what it meant to me was looking in each of, I chose 7 to highlight, each of these communities looked at the ways in which the ways they engaged in their community with the labyrinth exemplified hopeful and creative uses that seemed to, from my interview with them and my visiting, seem to have an impact on both creating community, building it, and providing some sense of transformation for individuals and community. So each of the 7 had very unique ways in which they did that in their communities. And so I just lifted up the highlights of those particular visits. For example, in a small neighborhood called Rivoli Park in Indianapolis. Lisa Boyles and her husband bought the empty lot next to them that had become really a place that had some negative energy, had some negative engagement with folks in the community, not a safe place. And they had this vision of transforming this vacant lot into a labyrinth and a sacred open space that would provide places for the community to engage, neighbors to know one another, groups from different areas of the city to come in and participate. And in a few short years, they have really provided a place of transformation, hospitality, welcome, to many, many groups of people in that community. So that's what I mean by the best practices, lifting up what seemed unique and hopeful in each one of those sites.
And in your study, did you find that the type of labyrinth, the design, the materials, did that have a factor in this, in the results, or was it just in addition to? I mean, was this a part of your research? Did you see this showing up routinely throughout your research, or was the type of labyrinth that was chosen, the materials, and the community involvement in construction of it, was that an integral part or not?
I did not begin by asking that question or include that in the questions, but what I did notice is that each community was very intentional about which design they chose so that it fit the population that they were serving. And for instance, in the local community here in the adult retirement community, they actually had what they called a walk-off, where they put several varieties of labyrinth designs out for all of the residents to walk and to give feedback on. And they decided on one in particular that seemed to fit the needs of older adults with limited mobility. So each one of these communities looked at that way ahead of time and chose a particular labyrinth that fit. So that is what struck me about that particular idea of which labyrinth seemed to be most effective. I think it is different for each community.
That's pretty interesting that the communities that you did interview really took the time to look at that and were very conscientious about picking the one that really fit the community, and that's wonderful to hear. It really is wonderful to hear.
Thank you.
So you sent me a couple of photos, and one of them, which I used for the episode photo, was a photo of your World Peace Labyrinth. So you helped create this 24-foot canvas labyrinth, and it's in memory of your dad, your father, and you said that he was active in peacemaking and restorative justice issues between the First Nations of Canada and the Canadian government for many years. Are you Canadian? Are you born and raised in Canada?
No, I'm not. I was born and raised in the United States, but my father moved to Canada because he was recruited there for some particular work in the Canadian government, which led to this position in the Canadian government of assisting with the issues of conflict between the government and the First Nations peoples. Then he later did work in alternative dispute mediation in the city of Toronto after he retired and was active in peacemaking circles. So he's not native, but he thoroughly loved Canadian culture once he moved there.
And so to explain what you mean by the term restorative justice as opposed to social justice?
Well, I don't think they're opposed to one another, but what I would give as a brief definition of restorative justice, I think restorative justice is a part of social justice, and it emphasizes the repairing of harm caused by certain behaviors. Sometimes those are criminal behaviors. My dad would work with juveniles who had committed some kind of an offense to someone, against someone in Toronto, and then they would work to try to restore the relationship. So it's best accomplished through cooperative processes that allow all the stakeholders to meet, and hopefully that leads to a transformation of people, relationships, and communities. That's one form of social justice, is as opposed to retributive justice, which focuses on crime and proportionate punishment. It does not really have an extrinsic social purpose other than, getting people to pay for whatever error that they made. Restorative justice aims to not only help restore the relationship that was broken by the offense, but the person is also held accountable and they figure out a mutual, the agreed upon way for that person to kind of pay back. And I think the labyrinth actually is a powerful transformational practice that can be used by communities in conflict to foster the restoration of relationships instead of focusing so much on retribution and punishment.
So tell us now about the labyrinth, this World Peace Labyrinth, and how that enters into this idea of restorative justice. Talk about it in a unique design. It's a unique design.
Well, yes, the design was actually commissioned and created by John Ritter of Pax Works in Indianapolis. He was commissioned by the Winter Salt Lake City Olympic Committee to create a design that would foster a community and images and symbols of peace. And so it's created with 7 focal points, circular, embedded within the labyrinth that represent the 7 continents of the world. On his original World Peace Labyrinth were painted in those focal areas symbols of peace from across cultures and traditions. And then the athletes were asked to bring symbols of peace from their communities and cultures and place them in the labyrinth so that visitors and athletes alike had a common ground space that focused on peace. And so that particular design appealed to me with my interest in restorative justice and peacemaking. And so John graciously allowed me to use that design to create my canvas labyrinth.
And yeah, the canvas labyrinth, your circles are blank. Is that correct? On your labyrinth.
They are. I have left them blank, and then I have extra circles of canvas that actually have different themed paintings on them so that they are interchangeable for the particular community that I've been invited into and the focus of their walk. Peacemaking work being one of them. So it's an adaptable labyrinth for whatever community would like to use it for.
And it is how many circuits? 7?
Yes. 7 circuits. It has a large center, which I chose intentionally because it's holds more people. And when I do labyrinth walks, I often have a debriefing time afterward, and we sit in that larger center and talk about the theme of that particular time and what was evoked for people in that time. A couple weeks ago at the Global Peace Film Festival in Orlando, Florida, we had 4 walks for preschool children, and we walked together with them and then gathered in the center at the end and talked about what what is peace between people and individuals and families. And it was a beautiful space to hold that with them.
That sounds like I would love to have been a fly on the wall to see the children. So you had kids in the labyrinth, in the center of the labyrinth, sitting there with you.
Yes, going on, you know, talking about what their experience was like on the labyrinth. And their teachers were with us as well, sitting in the circle with them.
So you traveled. This is a traveling canvas labyrinth. You obviously, you just gave us an example. Where else can you give us some more examples of how you've used this? Did the people, you have these circles that you can put inside of the circle on the labyrinth. Now, there's one in every quarter, so there's how many circles, open, blank circles, do you have?
There are seven blank circles.
Okay. And you have a different piece of canvas or painting to put in each one of those? And do you select for the community, or does the community select the one they want to use?
Well, if the community selects a particular one that I do not have, then I will make a temporary, if I don't have time to paint or create it on canvas, I'll create some temporary images. For instance, in Gainesville, Florida, about a year and a half ago, there was an interfaith environmental gathering, and so we used symbols of from the earth and from different faith traditions in those particular circles, and I made temporary symbols for that. But I have like each of the seven circles, I have like a seven circles with a particular theme. So there's sets of seven.
And you painted these yourself? These are all your own work?
Myself and my niece, Laura, who is a young artist, she assists me as well.
So talk a little bit about, you've given me but I'd like to know more about the some examples of what you've experienced with this labyrinth. What has been the feedback from some of these events? What have people said to you, that like the children? And can you, we always love to hear this. Everybody who listens to these interviews loves to hear how people respond.
Sure. One example I'd like to offer up is when a women's clergy group that I was a part of brought a labyrinth to the Pace Center for Girls, which is a center in Jacksonville for young girls who are really in very difficult situations in family and life and economics. And one particular walk included several teenage girls. And after we finished the walk, and it was completely silent during the walk, there were two things that happened. One, following the walk, we had a table for the girls to be able to journal or draw or paint. And the symbols and the words and the images were particularly poignant. And the opportunity to sit in the circle and debrief with them, in particular, there was one young girl whose mother was about to get out of jail the next day. She had been in jail for a very long time. And the particular walk gave her a profound sense of peace and a time to really focus on preparing for her mother's release from jail. The teachers who observed the walk commented that they had not heard that group of girls in that kind of deep silence ever. And so it provided a very unique opportunity for them to be in silence, in safety, in stillness, and then some deep listening afterwards. That particular young girl was particularly encouraged and affirmed as she prepared for her mom to come home.
And I think you mentioned before this idea of space. Is that? I'm sorry for the echo. I have a new mic and I can't figure out how close I'm supposed to get or not close. This idea of space and silence, do you feel this is connected, that this is an intrinsic characteristic of the labyrinth that makes this tool so valuable, this idea of, and are they connected? Because you mentioned space, it gives people space, and then you talk about silence, that there is this, is this a connection?
Absolutely, Christiana. My research looked at levels of anxiety and lack of spaces that people have for silence and listening and discernment, and in our culture in particular. And frequently people will say to me, I haven't experienced that kind of silence in a very long time, or I have never been silent with a group before, and walking in silence together has its own particular supportive energy and a sense of deep peace for people. I do think that the labyrinth offers a unique, safe, quiet space that is countercultural and is an antidote to the huge amounts of both chatter in terms of our technology that we are consumed by, in terms of the political anxiety that we are experiencing, even in this election in 2016, in a culture of busyness and in a culture that does not always reward people taking time and space out to really process and discern and think through things. And so, yes, I think there's a definite connection.
And I would point to the restorative justice aspect of this, in that here you have, in this that one example that you have with a young girl, and it, so the impact on her was obvious to the people there, but there's also an impact on her family and the mother, who will have a very different child in front of her than what was possible before by walking that labyrinth. I mean, there is a certain, there's a snowball effect or a domino effect here, which is also, was that a part of your thesis that noted in your work as well, your research as well?
That particular story was not noted in the research, but it was a part of the journey of my research, because it was one example of many of what happens in terms of relationship deepening as a result of giving yourself or a group that amount of space. One other example that I might mention that is more in the realm of relationship deepening is in the area of the adult retirement community. We had an older woman who had macular degeneration, and she could not negotiate the labyrinth as quickly as the younger ones who had come from the community. It wasn't all retirement community folks. It was a mixture. And as she walked very slowly, she was the last person to get on the labyrinth. The first person had already finished. The first person asked to go again, and I said, please, will you just wait just a moment and allow Dorothy to make her walk. She was very slow and very deliberate, Dorothy was. And so this young woman waited. And when she entered the labyrinth following Dorothy, she stopped behind her. And then she knew she could go around her, but she decided to walk behind her slowly, almost in her footsteps at a respectful distance behind her. And they walked that way the entire time. When the labyrinth walk was over and we sat in the circle to debrief, the young woman began to cry and said, "Dorothy, as I walked behind you, I was aware of walking in my mother's footsteps. You look like my mother, and you have the countenance of my mother, and my mother died a month ago. And it was such a blessing to be able to walk in your footsteps." And immediately Dorothy began to weep and said to Susan, "Susan, a few weeks ago, my husband John died, and my family was not able to be here for all of this time following, and it has been very lonely and very difficult. And you are the age of my daughter." And the two of them embraced, never having met before, 40 to 50 years apart in age. And there was this beautiful mutual support that came from walking in silence. And then the rest of us, the group, was very impacted by the way in which these two had provided healing to one another in the silence.
I think this is a good example of what we call weaving, the interwovenness of emotional energy and labyrinth energy, if you will, the synchronicity that appears over and over again when labyrinths are being used in respectful and intentional ways like this. And this is a beautiful example of that, seems to me.
Yeah.
So you also sent me, thank you for sharing that. That was lovely. You also sent me a photo of you and Chris Farrow Noble holding some seedlings, plants, starter plants, in front of, it looked like a garden labyrinth. And it was in the background, and it looked like that some of the lines had been planted already, and there were plants growing. So talk a little bit about what else you've been doing in the realm of building community. Obviously, this is another area where you're not using your canvas labyrinth, but you're still involved in this this endeavor, in this type of ministry.
Thank you. Yes, I just returned from Los Angeles, where as a part of the Veriditas Facilitators Council, Chris Noble and I, who was in the picture, were part of the Veriditas Council that met at the Echo Park Retreat Center, which is part of the Diocese of L.A. We met for our biannual meeting, but as part of our biannual meeting, we now hold Days of Renewal for local labyrinth facilitators in whatever community that we come to. And this particular renewal day had, as a part of the day, an hour for us to go right next door to the retreat center to the Living Labyrinth, which is an outdoor garden labyrinth, which produces vegetables and herbs and all kinds of food for the Ministry of Feeding the Homeless People in the Echo Park neighborhood. And it was the season to plant the fall crop of vegetables in the Living Labyrinth. And so all who came to the renewal day were invited outside and each given seedlings and instructed on how to plant them in the Living Labyrinth. And this project is in partnership between the diocese and also a nonprofit organization called Seeds of Hope. We received information about how that organization cares for vulnerable people in that community. We got an example of how a labyrinth in a community can be transformational for not only the spiritual needs of the community, but the physical needs of the community. And it was a beautiful time of coming together. I planted cauliflower. That was my plant.
And who started this?
It was a partnership between the Seeds of Hope and the diocese, and the person who was the person who spoke to us, I can get you his name if you'll just give me one moment. I will find it for you. But it was definitely a community partnership, which I found to be true of most of the community labyrinths that I highlighted in my thesis project. There was an element of not just one particular organization being the founder or being the sole participant. Most of these labyrinths chose at the outset to engage with other organizations in the city. For instance, the Mary E. Castle Elementary School Peace Park was an exciting partnership between PROACT Indy, between the school system there and the neighborhood of in where the school was located. That seemed to be a very significant, consistent fact about all of these labyrinths. The people who presented to us on the Living Labyrinth in Echo Park in Los Angeles were Tim Alderson, he's the Seeds of Hope Executive Director, and Chantel Zimmerman of the Art and Soul Lab, and she is also a Veritas Labyrinth Facilitator.
I know Chantel very well. I haven't seen her since the gathering in Vancouver Island, but I know her very well. She's very, very enthusiastic about her labyrinth work. It's wonderful. So that's wonderful to know. So do you think that the combination of these communities, that it's more effective, did you find that once the labyrinth is built and you have your opening ceremony or whatever, that the labyrinths that had this interwoven community participation lasted longer or were more active? Did you get any feedback about that or any research about that?
I haven't done a post-study or longitudinal study, that's a very interesting question. But what I did find at the point of the visit and the follow-up interviews was that the more that those labyrinths do engage other aspects of the community, for instance, I know you've interviewed Reginald Adams. His emphasis really includes many different people from different parts of the community and organizations. The Centennial Labyrinth in Sydney, Australia, Emily Simpson brought together people from the government of Sydney, from all of the faith traditions in Sydney, community groups. I have found that in the span of my study that there is a dynamic to partnered labyrinths, I might call them, that uniquely provides ongoing, life-giving engagement in the community.
And especially if there's a, you know, there's a bigger pool of people so that you have sort of a regenerative aspect to the committee itself. You know, other people come in, some people retire, other people come in. So there is that aspect as well, I would imagine, if you have a number of different, you know, sources for engagement with people.
Exactly.
Yeah. So where do you see your labyrinth path taking you now? What's on the horizon for you, Catherine?
Well, one of my hopes is to be able to incorporate the World Peace Labyrinth into the work of a local organization here in Jacksonville called the Interfaith Coalition for Action, Reconciliation, and Empowerment, which has already established neighborhood accountability boards and school-based accountability boards that practice restorative justice. So as opposed to sending a young person to detention or suspending them from school or, making them go to the juvenile detention center, they have already begun this practice of restorative justice in terms of trying to reestablish right relationship. My hope is that the labyrinth will begin to be integrated in that so that it can be included in the schools. And as Lauren Archer sometimes says, you know, we need a time in instead of a time out. Encouraging children and those in conflict to have a time of quiet and reflective work toward restoration and reconciliation, as opposed to just sending people away from their communities in a punishing kind of way. So that is my hope, to be able to integrate it into that work here in the community.
And it sounds like, just as Reginald's work, that if you get them young enough and you start them down this path of restoration and involvement and using the labyrinth to be more introspective and appreciate silence and space and as a peaceful means of reconciliation and problem solving, you might impact the larger issues down the road, especially in terms of incarceration.
Exactly. And I live in what is often termed the murder capital of Florida. We have an extremely high rate of violence in our community. So the more that we can do, both myself and also we have a new legacy labyrinth built in Jacksonville area that is committed to peacemaking and healing work in the community. And so we have a lot of work to do here to teach our children ways to prevent conflict instead of always waiting until it happens and then having to figure out a way forward. But Reginald's exactly right. Teach your children in the way that they should go, and they will have some wonderful models for dealing with what they will face in the future.
Yeah, because it sounds to me healing and using the labyrinth as a healing tool is absolutely invaluable and important. But to come to prevent the actions and the repercussions that would end up needing to be healed is even almost not more valuable, but just as important, if not more so, in the first place. You know, and that sounds to me like what you're talking about with this program. It sounds like a wonderful program.
Well, I'm hoping that happens with the labyrinth, but I'm encouraged to know that we've at least gotten to the point of having these accountability boards and these neighborhood accountability boards, which actually meet with kids in their own neighborhood and have local adults and older teens helping to work through the conflict. So as much as we can create space for conversation and building and deepening relationships and reducing anxiety between peoples, I think we are doing good work with the Labyrinth.
So are you excited to come to the gathering and network with other people, other like-minded people who are doing similar things as you are in their own areas and in their own way? Lisa Moriarty is one, you know, besides Reginald, is another one, and she's giving a workshop on this.
Absolutely. Lisa's done great work with her conflict resolution labyrinth, and I really admire. And her and Ellen Bintz Mutch has done some amazing work with labyrinths in prisons and with her global healing response focus. So I'm feel honored to be able to be in conversation with these folks, and also look forward to, you know, offering the Peace Labyrinth in whatever community invites me to come. So thank you so much for the chance to share some of this.
Well, it's been great, and thank you for joining me today. We don't have anyone logged in. People don't at this point. Well, it's also in the morning. Most people are working. So if they're listening, they're working while they're listening. So I wanted to talk to you now, in terms of the Labyrinth community, what would you like to see the Labyrinth community? How would you like to see the regional community, the world proceed in the next 5 years or so? I mean, you know, what do you see the need is? Where do you see that the need is greatest?
Well, as I interviewed people, one of the things that came across consistently, especially with Labyrinth enthusiasts and people who were outside of the U.S., were that they are seeking community themselves in order to be, you know, empowered and encouraged to continue their work in their particular areas. So I think there's we've trained a lot of people through Veritas, and other organizations have trained people to do Labyrinth work. And now I think the work is moving towards supporting those facilitators and continuing to educate them and providing opportunities for gathering and mutual support, particularly for folks outside the U.S. where there is not as much community support. And so I hope that the organizations, the Labyrinth Society, Veritas, and other organizations might be able to continue conversation about how we build a community on a larger global sense.
And that includes getting information to these people and making them aware of what's available in terms of the studies. And I mean, you know, you have somebody in Iceland or you know, Spain or someplace who wants to build a labyrinth in the community, and they have to deal with the bureaucracy there, and they have to deal with whatever community that they want, and where do they get this information? I think it's also, that's also another aspect to this, is getting them the information that they need.
I think so as well, and one of the things that I found was that some of the people I interviewed had never really been able to have a chance to tell their story about their labyrinth work. So my study was very limited based on the parameters of my the seminary requirements. But the stories that came as from labyrinth facilitators about their own journey with the labyrinth as well as the journey with their communities, was powerful, and so many of them said, thank you for listening to my story. And so at some point, I hope to extend my work from the interviews to be able to tell some of their stories. And as much as information is important and helpful and integral to someone continuing their work, being heard and a story being received by another is just as important.
I totally agree with you. I know that I have aspects of my labyrinth path that I've really never told anybody. And when I've told bits and pieces, people look at me and say, how come you haven't written that down? How come you haven't told it? And I'm like, well, it's just a lot to get. And I don't know why. So I think a lot of people are that way. And I think that what you're saying is that you don't know how impactful your story is until you share it. And that it makes a difference to other people, that other people get, you don't know what the benefit is until you share it.
Right.
For others that are saying, going through the exact same thing, because again, it's synchronistic. You know, somebody will hear something and go, oh my God, that's exactly what I'm going through. Oh good. Now I don't feel so alone.
Right.
Yeah. Yes, I think it is. So maybe more of a forum. I think it's wonderful that you're planning on doing this. Collecting stories will be very helpful. It'll be another must-have book, labyrinth book on my bookshelf in the future, for sure. But also some kind of forum for people to go and write their stories that other people can read. And maybe listen to. So perhaps that's another direction this podcast can go into as well, having people tell their stories.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, I think we don't have any more questions, and I think we are pretty much finished. I mean, I know I could ask you, 10 more questions easily, but I know that you're giving your workshop at the gathering on Friday. It's a 90-minute workshop, correct?
Correct.
And so all of you out there who are coming to the gathering, please come to Catherine's workshop, and also there will be information on the gathering on the Labyrinth Society website about her workshop, as well as all other concurrent workshops presenters. So you can check there as well. So I guess we will wrap this up, Catherine, and I'm so looking forward to meeting you in another 2 weeks. And thank you so much for sharing this hour with me and with the listeners, whether they're live or whether they'll listen to it later. And thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Christiana. It's been an honor to have this conversation. Thank you.
And many blessings, many continued blessings on your path.
And for you.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
You've been listening to the Labyrinth Society's Many Paths, Many Visions, broadcast by Spreaker with your host, Christiana Brinton. I apologize for the echo today. I think I have this down now with my new mic. Be sure to check the Labyrinth Society website, the Facebook page, Global Group, YouTube, and Google Plus for a list of upcoming dates and guests. For more information, please go to www.labyrinthsociety.org. Ciao, namaste, and may you find what you need on your path through life.